This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. When I was in Louisville, Kentucky for the joint convention of the International Brotherhood of Magicians and the Society of American Magicians, I was giving daily updates from the convention floor as I normally do. So those of you who listen to those hopefully will appreciate each day that I go and talk with a variety of different people who are the guests, performers there, as well as some of the dealers and registrants, and maybe some of the things that are happening in and around the convention location then as well. But nevertheless, this year, I was talking with some of the people. I just finished talking with George Schindler, and I turned and I saw Martin Lewis, and I thought, well, let's just chat with him for a moment, because he was one of the performers and lecturers there at the convention as well. Well, as we got into it, I realized that this is going to be a very interesting conversation that bears more than just a cursory conversation, and something that I thought might be a little bit longer that you guys would enjoy. So I continued our conversation, and it turned out to be just some wonderful information that he had shared with us in this conversation, in which we were talking about his father, we were talking about dealing with audiences and creativity, the development of his cardiographic cartoon card rise, a variety of things. Anyhow, this is one of those things that I kind of, again, caught him in the hallway over there. So there's a little bit of ambient noise, but nothing is distracting. So please welcome my guest this week, Martin Lewis, here on The Magic Word. Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com, and as we are leaving, I just talked with George Schindler a second ago, but one of the performers from last evening's show and the lecturer for this afternoon, I happen to run into here as well, and that's Martin Lewis. Hey there, Martin.
Hi, hello everybody.
And so you were just starting to tell me, I was asking about the silk bandanas, and yeah. I was noticing also, I was looking for that actually online, and I was looking at the something on the Magic Cafe, and they didn't know either. People were, you know, so where can they find a silk bandanas like what you were using?
Well,
for the red and white trick.
Yeah, the my idea is I don't like the magician's silk so much. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're good for when you're doing a silk routine,
well, sure.
But for just calling them a handkerchief, I don't think it's convincing. So I wanted some silks printed to look like bandanas, which, of course, would be more recognizable to people.
Right.
And I did a bit of searching around, and I found a fellow named Tim Sommerfeld. Now, Tim has a company, Wonder Imagery, which you can find at wonderimagery.com, and he'll custom print silks for you. Now, he's already got the patterns for the bandanas.
Okay.
So you can just email him and say, oh, I'd love to have a couple of those bandanas that Martin Lewis uses.
Okay.
and he makes them in a variety of different colors, and it'll do one off. And the nice thing also is if you have an idea for a silk trick, years ago you had to go to Howard Rice and try and get them specially printed, which was next to impossible because of their techniques. But he can actually print one off. So,
Techniques have changed so much. I was doing a trade show for a company, and this would have been approximately 1994, I think, or 95. And the company had a new name that they were, or a new logo they were rolling out. And I found someone who could print up like 500 of these handkerchiefs. And so I was doing a routine with, you know, color changing. Then I would hand out the handkerchiefs, you know, at the trade show to people who were passing by, you know, as pocket squares, because they were very nice. And they had the logo on it and everything.
Oh,
on
sure.
But they were quite expensive back then because of the technique you said that they had to use.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. But today, again, just doing one off, just like desktop printing, you know, everybody can publish a book, you know, easily and cheaper.
Oh, yeah. The state of technology. I'm producing, or in the process of producing, a smaller version of my cardiographic sketchpad card rise. And I've got a machine that actually does the artwork. You put a Sharpie in the machine, and you program it, and the Sharpie touches the paper and draws your picture for you. And then when it's done that, it then puts a cutter in place and cuts around the pattern. So. This thing had never existed a few years ago,
right?
But now that it's affordable, it's something you can put into an office.
Right, yeah, for making up the tablet. I mean, I've been using that ever since I
Gosh, who did I first see doing that? I want to say it might have been Michael Weber or Dan Garrett. I think it was at one of the Las Vegas seminars way back when.
Well, those two guys are the pioneers of that trick, yeah.
And once that was published and made available, I've been doing it in my shows. It's beautiful. My little secret that I use is, I think you talk about having a button, and I use an O-ring, you know, that's... Mm-hmm. About the size of a 50-cent piece or base something. So this way I can stick my thumb through the O-ring, and also because it's rubber, I can squeeze it through the spiral, you know, easily. You know?
That's an interesting idea, yeah. The one we're doing now uses, I'm in the process of producing a more economical version. Mm-hmm. It's a great trick, and I built a professional model, but it's a couple of $100s, and, right. You know, for the magician is not going to perform it all the time. So I'm making it a little bit smaller, something that fits in a backpack. And the big complaint I get is, and you will know this if you've done it a lot, reset.
Yeah.
You got to fiddle around to reset it. This one has a 10-second reset, so...
10 seconds?
Yeah.
Wow.
Seconds.
Yeah, when I was working at the Magic Island in Houston, it's not like the Castle where that you have two or three stage shows a night. There could be as many as six shows in a night, and so I was backstage quickly preparing for the next show, you know.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a torn restored newspaper. I mean, once you know how to do it, you can quickly do it. However, it still takes time. But a 10-second reset's awesome.
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm happy with that.
Wow. Yeah. A completely different direction. I wanted to ask you about Earthquake Muldoons. Was that
Magoons? Yeah.
Now that was in the Bay Area. Is that right? Mm-hmm. And tell me a little bit about that part of history. And they found the Carter posters and all this kind of information stuff back there.
Turk Murphy had a jazz band, a traditional jazz, and it had a premises on 630 Clay Street called Earthquake Magoons, which was the home of Turk Murphy's jazz band. Mm-hmm. And Turk was an avid car collector, antique car collector, and he rented a livery stable down on the waterfront where he had two or three of his classic cars. And one of them was an old SS Jaguar, which he had upon blocks. And they wanted to do some work on it. And it slid back off the blocks and hit the back wall of the livery stable.
Oh, wow.
And broke a big hole in it.
Uh-huh.
And so they were sort of mortified. But they moved the car out of the way. And he looked at the hole to see how to repair it and realized there was something behind the wall. So they dug away a little bit and they found there was a trunk. And then they tried to pull the trunk out, but they couldn't because there was so much weight on the top of it. Mm-hmm. So they took more of the wall away. The entire back wall was a false wall, and it was piled with a complete traveling stage act of Carter the Great, who was one of the Golden Age magicians, of course.
He had a lot of paper.
Oh, he had a lot of paper. But all the costumes, all of his illusion show, with the exception of the Lion's Bride, which he... there's a reason that he didn't have that. But everything else was there. So, Turk...
Did Le Great Lafitte have the Lion's Bride? Did he get that? Was that the same one where he
same
was...
Same one, yeah. But okay. These guys stole from each other left, right, and center.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
What happened, Carter had gone off to India to tour with a small show. So he only took the Lion's Bride and some smaller apparatus with him. Mm-hmm. And he died over there. That was, you know... like a good magician, instead of locking up all of his gear, he put it in the stable and then built a false wall in front of it.
Before he went overseas?
Before he went, yeah.
Of course, not knowing he was going to die.
Yeah, of course.
But the fact that you would actually go to that extreme to hide something.
Well,
wow.
You know,
nobody knew about it. Was he married or his family knew I knew about it or forgot about it?
Nobody knew about it. Or at least if they did, they'd know.
Now, did he live there?
Yes, he was a lawyer in San Francisco for a long time.
Did not know that. Yeah. Okay. I mean, I read the book, but I remember that.
It was lost. It was just forgotten back there. Mm-hmm. So Turk calls up the lady who owns the livery stable and said, "Well, we've unfortunately knocked a hole in your wall." And she said, "Well, you better pay to fix it." And he said, "Well, there's all this stuff behind there." And she goes, "Yes, I know." So she did know about it. But I'm not going to pay to have that stuff hauled down to the dump. So Turk said, "We'll haul it away for you for free."
Yeah.
and we'll repair the wall and good
with some
as
of the
new.
Money we can from the sales.
And so she was very happy about that.
Uh-huh.
And he moved it all to the basement of his club, which was just an empty basement.
Yeah.
And then the piano player in the band, Peter Klute, his brother, Cedric, was an amateur historian. And Cedric went down and said, you've got a real find here. And Cedric started to catalogue it. And they put it on, they would take people, friends down and say, oh, look at all this old magician stuff. And eventually they opened up the Magic Cellar there, which was a nightclub for with magicians.
And that was where you performed then?
That was where I performed, yeah.
You were a regular there, as I recall.
Yeah, I was there. I was their house magician for 4 years.
Doing close-ups?
Close-up, yeah. Because mm-hmm. I studied close-up at the Magic Castle with mm-hmm. Vernon and Charlie Miller and all of those guys.
Right.
But when I went there, my dad had moved to San Francisco. Eric Lewis. Had moved to restore Robert Albo's collection of Akito props.
Was he a particularly good artist, or was he skilled at repairing things?
My dad?
Yes. Okay.
He was...
Albo invited him over, or he...
Yes, invited him. He was. My dad was one of the few remaining master craftsmen. Him, Carl Williams, and a few others were the guys that really knew about this old stuff and how it should be and how it should look. So, yeah, my dad did a lot of restoration work.
So it wasn't just for him, because he came and worked with them and then went back home. Okay, gotcha, for Albo. And then,
yeah.
Okay. So he came and worked, I'm sorry, I interrupted.
Yeah, no, it's okay. He did the work for Doc Albo.
Yeah.
And when that work was finished, he moved back to Los Angeles. But he was there for 4 or 5 years.
Wow.
Because this is a huge collection now.
Yeah. Whatever happened to all of Albo's stuff?
I have no idea.
His
wife Marjorie, of course, is still around, so she would know what it is. But I would have a feeling it. I don't think anybody would buy it, unless it was David Copperfield, would buy it whole.
Yeah.
You know, the whole thing. So it may have been piece by piece out. Or knowing Marjorie, she may just keep it. I don't know.
Do they have children?
Yes, I think so.
He had given some of his collection to the Magic Island in Houston that was on display, and that the island closed back in October of 2008. My wife and I were actually the last act that were there because Hurricane Ike came through, and long story, but anyhow, it closed, and they just basically shut the door with all the stuff inside there. And so all those posters and, you know, card star and antique, you know, P&L things that he had owned that he gave to the island. At first I thought they were on loan, but apparently, as I understand it, they're owned, not on loan, but owned by the owner of the Magic Island. Right. And so it's still sitting there, just kind of collecting mildew, unfortunately.
You know, that's something you should do something about that.
We have tried, you know, and the guy just won't let us in, and yeah, he wants to sell the whole thing. He still thinks it's worth $3 million, you know.
Oh, well, he's an idiot, okay.
Well, yeah.
So
there's a lot
that
to
explains
this.
That, yeah.
Exactly. Right. But Magoon's closed then. Well,
yes,
let me back up just a second. How the heck did when you said that there was a trunk back there, and she said, oh, I know about that, but I don't want to take it down. How did she know about that? She knew it was there, but it was...
Yeah, apparently. I mean, it was the livery stables in her family, so she...
Oh, I see.
She was
someone within her family who knew Carter and knew
said,
that had
know,
been...
There's a whole bunch of junk behind that wall, you know, yeah. And she just said, well, what do I want with a whole bunch of magic junk?
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
So
okay.
Not having any idea the value of what she... the very first crate they pulled out was just packed full of posters. And some 16 to 32 sheets in perfect condition. So one of those posters paid for the entire
exactly.
renovation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So your dad lived in the UK, and you were born in the UK,
yeah.
I guess. How long did you live there?
I moved to California in 1968,
okay.
So a long time ago.
So you were like, 8 years old?
Oh, I wish. I was 18
okay.
When I moved, and the drinking age in England, legal drinking age, is 18.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd been walking into pubs and having a beer or two for 6 or 7 months. Mm-hmm. When I came to the US, all of a sudden I was illegal again.
You got cut off, yeah.
Yeah. And for an 18-year-old, 19-year-old, that was the worst. But my sister married an American serviceman, so she moved to San Bernardino, mm-hmm. Where March Air Force Base is.
Okay.
And later my mother went to visit, and my mother was a Red Cross nurse, and she's getting paid by the National Health in England, which isn't a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So she found out what a nurse was earning in the U.S. and said, I want to stay here.
I'm staying here, yeah.
And because of her vocation, she was did have any problem getting a good job. My dad and my brother and I moved over later on, a couple of years later.
I see. Okay. And with your mom.
Yeah.
You know, there, correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't your dad, Eric, also have like a puppet that he had used also that he was quite well known for? And I was wondering if Sooty, the puppet, kind of came from that idea.
My dad was the guy that actually taught Harry Corbett how to do Sooty.
Okay, that's kind of what I was wondering.
Yeah,
okay.
Harry was a children's entertainer and had his television show coming up. And he said, I'd love to have some sort of a puppet character. And he had everything worked out, and he knew what he wanted. But he said, I love your little Freddy. He said later in years, Dad used the same puppet for almost 40 years. And he said, it's getting really worn out. That's why he calls him Fred, because he's Fred Bear.
Okay, Fred Bear, got it.
That was the origin of Sooty. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And Sooty's still going, from what I understand,
in different variations. Yeah. Yeah, I think his son carries it on, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And when was that approximately that your dad had come up with that idea?
Oh, that would be in...
Around the First World War?
Yeah, before then.
Yeah, wow.
Oh, not, no, no, no.
Yeah.
Before the second, it would... Around the 20s or late 20s.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, where would he have worked back then? I assume that they had, of course, back then they had nightclubs and things in the UK, which lasted a lot longer than they did in the United States.
Yeah, sure. But my dad mainly did birthday parties. He worked, obviously, in magicians' conventions because he created a lot of magic, and he had his company, Magicraft Studios, which produced a lot of magic. And he worked clubs and hotels and private engagements. So yeah, a lot of kid shows.
Right.
Yeah.
More kid shows than nightclubs, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you work many clubs over there at all? I mean, when you were getting involved in magic?
I had no interest in magic at all.
Really?
No, I wanted to be a bass player in a rock and roll group.
Okay.
But I was a rubbish player, so it never happened. But I was not interested in magic, and my interest started on September the 1st, 1968, at 7 o'clock at night.
Wow. Who can actually go to a point in time like that, so specific? Wow. Okay.
Yeah. It was my 21st birthday, and my dad took me to the Magic Castle, because, you have to be 21
right.
or older. And at that time, 7 o'clock, was the first performance by Albert Goshen in the close-up room. And I watched him, and I said, I have to learn this. Because my dad was a very creative and ingenious magician, but mainly children's entertainer. Mm-hmm. His books on children's magic are still being used today.
What are some of the titles?
Opus 21, Open Sesame. He wrote 21 books in total.
Wow, okay.
Yeah. But Open Sesame would be his probably most popular one.
Okay.
But Silly Billy, who's today's current expert on it, he says, almost everything I do I owe to your dad.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's where the puppet came from. Dad did a whole routine. He had a little building, like a little house, a puppet house, and you could show it empty like a tip-over box, and
right.
then different puppets would come out and do things.
Okay.
Yeah. And out of all of them, Freddie was the most popular, so he kept that. And when he moved to the U.S., he'd only ever done it for kids. And somebody said, you should do that in the Magic Castle, in the downstairs in the old theater there.
Theater down, yeah.
And he said, that's a kid's trick. And they said, well, you should try it. And so he did it for adults, and it just went over 100%. So he said, all these years, I never had any idea that this was... anything other than just a bit of fun for kids.
I used to do the Loda Bowl in children's parties when I was doing kids shows, and I always say, magic water from Zanzibar. And it got so then, Martin, that I had more of the parents afterwards coming over and talking to me. They were peeking into the bowl and saying, I like the show, but man, that water, where's that come from? And I heard that time after time, and I realized that the adults are being fooled if not equally, perhaps more than the children. And so I started putting that into my all my shows now. And so, in fact, the picture that Ted Salter had drawn for me, you know, a caricature at the castle, is of me pouring out a load of bowl. I mean, that's got to be like a trademark of Zanzibar, you know, for me, because I do it all the time. But it's one of those things that I didn't realize the impact on adults the same way, like you were talking about your pop. You know?
Yeah, it's funny. You can't tell. No. I've been creating magic tricks for almost 40 years, mm-hmm. and early on, I would look at a routine and I would go, "This is gonna kill. It has to. Every element is correct. Every line is perfect." It's, and I would go and do it, and the audience would look at me like I was from Mars. Mm-hmm. And I'm going, "But I don't understand. This is an absolute." But then, on the other hand, I would do tricks that I didn't think were very good tricks, like the egg bag. And the audience loved it. And again, I'm mystified. I can make an egg vanish in my bare hands with my sleeves rolled up.
Yeah.
Which I thought would be much more impressive than putting it in a black bag.
Bag, right.
But, no, but it isn't. So there's, so I think with everything, like with the Lotus Bowls, you just find out as you go along
what works.
Yeah.
It's just through flight time. Whenever you're performing it, eventually, you know, things will come. It's kind of like Matt King just spoke this morning at our breakfast about the development of his Cloak of Invisibility, mm-hmm. where that when he first did that, he got like crickets, you know. I mean, it was not funny at all. And then he kind of put it aside, and then later he had this idea that Peter Studebaker was talking with him about a Cards Across routine, and then he was thinking, well, I want to have a different presentation. Maybe I can be invisible, you know. And then he kind of, that came back to him again. So it's one of these things that kind of comes together.
Yeah, exactly. So it goes to show, right?
Right,
yeah.
That's right. So you saw Albert Goshman.
And that was an inspiration.
Seminal point.
Because obviously, you know, if you've ever seen Albert, and I believe there's some videos of him online now. It's startling. It is truly magical.
Yeah,
what
say, please.
Yeah, say please. Say please. So I said, "Dad, you've got to teach me, you know, I've got to learn something about this magic." So he said, "Well, here's a book," and he gave me The Royal Road to Card Magic. Here's a book of card tricks that you should look at this. So I went back to my apartment, and a few months later I went back and I said, "Okay, I can do all of those tricks. What's next?" And he said, "No, I don't need to, you can't do the tricks. You read the book." I said, "No, I learned all the tricks in the book, didn't?"
Wow.
And he said,
"Show me."
"No, you didn't." And I said, "Sure, which one do you?" And so he said, "That one." And I did it. I literally had learned every trick in that book, because I didn't know. I thought that was the book on cards.
Okay.
So I learned.
Which it was in many ways.
Yeah, it was true, yeah. And I did all it. So he said, "Okay, I'm going to give you a copy of a book called Bobo's Coin Magic. Don't learn all the tricks in it."
Just read it. Digest it, but don't. Yeah.
So, yeah, that was how I got started.
And so then, you remember some of your first shows and where you performed? I mean, you weren't doing kids' parties with card tricks and things,
no,
I guess.
No. I moved to an apartment very close to the Magic Castle, and I went there every single night without fail for 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm. And I that was where I studied magic. Mm-hmm. But I'm a very shy person, very introverted, and I don't. For me to perform in front of people would be impossible. I couldn't hold my hand steady enough. I would shake like a leaf if I even just thinking about it would. And my friends, my very close friends, is Mike Perovich, who's here at the convention this week, and Bruce Servan.
Yep.
And the three of us were thick as thieves.
Okay.
As you know, Bruce was a brilliant magician.
Yes. He was one of the first magicians. Whenever I went to the Magic Castle, he was working close up, and I think that Martin Nash was the other one. What a great night that was.
Wow, yeah. Another one that would inspire you, if nothing else.
Yeah.
So, eventually, Bruce, I did try a few tricks for people, you know, simple ones, and I believe it was difficult. Mm-hmm. But I kept pushing at it because I wanted to do it. And one night I'm sitting in the old Blackstone room, which is, you know, just around from the Closo room.
Behind Vernon, would say.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm just sitting talking with other magicians, and we get a crowd of people standing around the table. And somebody said, you should do something, Martin.
Do something, yeah.
And at that time, I was working on Slidini's helicopter card.
Oh, yeah. It's a great trick.
Well, yeah, if you know, it's a great trick,
yeah,
but you know,
it's Dick Cavett.
It's a tough trick to do.
It is.
You know, you have to do that Tenkai palm and loading and stuff. But that was in my mind, and it was in my head, so I started to do it for somebody. And about halfway through the trick, I had the card edge palmed, and I looked up, and I realized that not one of the people standing around had any idea what I was about to accomplish.
And you were so self-conscious.
Oh, incredibly self-conscious.
But you look around and realize, hey, they're buying it.
I said, oh. And all of a sudden, confidence restored, and I never had a moment's nervousness since.
Amazing.
Now, I say that, I'm nervous before every performance.
I think that you have to. You know, I've spoken with several professionals about that very thing about butterflies, that I think that Jeff McBride has said it best, you know, that you just need to kind of get butterflies moving in the same direction, you know. You just kind of had to corral them and get them going. I think that I heard that Johnny Carson would stand back behind the curtain and he would be nervous until he would hear his name, and then he would say the first joke. And it's the same thing whenever, you know, I think with most performers, when we walk out, when you get the first laugh, the first bit of applause, then you kind of get in your zone. But I think otherwise you don't seem fresh if you're not a little excited.
Yeah, and also I think you're nervous because you care about doing a good job.
Exactly. As well you should.
Yeah. And I see people go, oh, it doesn't bother me at all. I'm going, well, then you're complacent about what you're doing.
I've heard people say, well, I'm going to mail this one in. You know, I've worked when you're working at the island, again, you're doing show after show, and I was working with somebody whose name will remain nameless, but it kind of surprised me, and he said, I'm going to go mail this one in. And I kind of felt like that. He was doing a dove act, and he was smiling, but it wasn't fresh. You know, it was something he was missing. You know?
Yeah. It's probably happened to you. I know it happens to me once in a while. I'll be in the middle of my show and realize that my mind is actually wondering if I took the laundry out the dryer.
My wife does that whenever that she's in the wings and I'm waiting for her to come and hand me an envelope or something. She's over there making Christmas card lists or shopping. Oh, I'm supposed to be doing something.
And I found it's a syndrome. You do it so much and so often that your mind drifts while you're performing, which means you're not present, and that's a horrible thing. Well, you're cheating your audience by doing that. So now I always put at least one new line or any little thing in the show that keeps me in the present, because I know that it's coming, so my mind has to stay present.
So it's something new that you try to add, a line or something?
Just anything, just a simple line. In my lecture, well, there'll be some new stuff in there. But I'm going to make a reference to Jaden K. Smith, which won't mean anything to anybody unless you're a big fan of Facebook. And then, so all the Facebookers in the audience will laugh hilariously when I mention this name.
Okay.
But it's a sort of an unusual name, and I've got to keep it locked in my mind. So that's going to keep me present throughout that lecture.
That's interesting.
So
you intentionally try to put something in to keep you focused, so when that comes for the time to deliver that you don't overlook it.
Yeah, you don't overlook it, but also you're also focused on everything else that you're doing as well.
Now, what about the show that you did last evening? I mean, those are three solid things that you do all the time, cardiographic and the bamboo and the first thing, I'd forgotten what it was that you did.
The dying silk.
Silk tie. That. What was new, or what were you focused on in that one? Did you have something there?
Yes, the prediction with the news, with the tabloid paper.
Yes.
That's a fairly new effect.
I was going to say, you went a completely different direction than I thought you were going to go with that. I thought you were going to be doing your torn, restored newspaper that you had, you know, talk about at Magic Live or something, and then it's like, wait a minute, you did a prediction. That was really cool. I liked it.
But that was new, and with that, you get to read headlines or make comments about what's in the tabloid. So that's that was what kept me going there. And the line that I'd never done before was one of the headlines, and it's an actual headline from the National Enquirer, is Headless Body Found in Topless Bar.
Funny.
Which is
That's such a great line. It sounds like something that you need to keep in there. You know, it's a funny point.
Yeah. But the next show I do with that, I'll go through and I'll pick out another great headline. And then remembering that and keeping it, it will keep me fresh for the, and not just for the trick, for the entire show.
That's interesting. So really in every show that you're always thinking of something that's going to be keeping you focused and fresh. And so how long typically is your show when you're performing professionally?
Of course, it varies a lot depending on
what they want.
I retired 4 or 5 years ago, but I'm still working, which is sort of...
Just retired?
Let me say, I started taking my pension in.
Okay. Because you kept your UK citizenship. You're not a...
No.
You're an American?
American, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Take your pension. So what... Or you mean Social Security? Or?
Social Security. Okay, but I have a British pension as well.
Okay,
so
I see.
Yeah. So I have, you know, two. But I still love to do the conventions and...
And occasional lectures.
Yeah, occasional lectures. I work mainly on ships for most of my career. That was what I wanted to be, was a cruise ship magician. Even in the early days when it was considered to be beneath everybody to be working those ships. Now they all want to do it, but I have a good agent for cruise lines. And when I retired, I said I'll do 4 or 5 of the, you know, the good lines every year.
And Ron Wilson used to book a lot of those.
Yeah, Ron was... he was a great booker, but he wasn't judicious. He had his list of people, and when a cruise line called him up, he would start at the top of the list until he found somebody that could do the job, and then he would book them for it.
They were friends of his, or people who would...
Well, his client list, you know.
Okay.
He had a list of people. Well, cruise ships are all different, and they require different types of entertainers. But Ron didn't care, you know, who he was sending. It was the first person he could get a hold of that could do it.
Okay.
And he kept me busy for a long time, so God bless Ron.
Yeah.
But the agents now, the cruise ships require certain qualities out of a performer.
That's what I was about to say. It really has changed a lot from the standpoint when I last cruised, then the agent contacted me, said, if you could do some comedy, you know, we'd like to see more comedy and less magic. You know, I can book comedians a lot easier than I can book magicians now.
Sure.
I guess because they have less stuff to call around, carry.
Yeah, maybe. So they still call me a comedy magician, is an appellation I don't care for. I'm a magician. I use humor in my act, but I'm a magician.
Period. Yeah. Okay.
Humor is part of my toolbox.
Yeah.
But it isn't, I can't come out and just, come out and just do humor.
Kind of like David Diebel did. You know, David comes out and does about 10 or 50, however long, you know, of just comedy, and then he does a little bit of juggling, magic, or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's along those lines, you know. When you think of comedy magicians, generally they don't do magic very well. You know, they're comedians that have learned to do a bit of magic.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there's some obvious exceptions.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to be a magician, and I studied hard. All those years at the castle, sitting around with, as I say, Charlie Miller-Vernon and Larry Jennings, Mike Skinner, I can execute a fairly decent second deal. I can do a shift, pass, palm, top change, all of those things, mm-hmm. well enough to deceive an audience. I've never used them ever.
That's fun for a magician.
But I've got chops, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
what defines a comedy magician?
Well, that's a good question. Carl Ballantyne defines a comedy magician.
Ah, there you go.
Yeah.
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 What about how quickly that you grab an audience with magic? In other words, that you're a magician who happens to have funny things. When you open, how quick is your first effect, I guess, to let people know that you really are a magician?
Almost immediately.
Which I think is important.
Yes, I think so too.
Otherwise, they're wondering, what's this guy going to do and where's he going? And then they lose interest if nothing happens fairly quickly.
Yeah, the first thing I do is I establish my character by which is, I have that sort of dry British wit. So I say
that everybody loves.
So I'll say, you know, I'll show you this magic. I'm going to teach you a magic trick, and if I hear enough applause, I'll show you how it's done. If I don't hear enough applause, I'll just do it again and again and again, and that they suddenly realize, okay, this guy's not serious, right?
Yeah.
And then immediately I do the first color change, and they see something happen.
Right.
So
that's always been an opening trick for you.
Always, yeah, yeah. At the Magic Cellar, when I moved from doing close-up at the close-up table to working, we built a small stage because we were getting a lot more people in. I talked to my dad. I said, you know, I've got to start doing stage magic, and I have no table that's sitting between me, you know, because right. I used to love to sit. What do I do? He said, pick just two or three tricks that you like, preferably classics, and really study them. Do them as well and as best as, do them better than anybody's ever done them before. That's what you should do. So I chose the Dying Silks, which I'd learned from Di Vernon before, the Linking Rings, which I'd learned from Di Vernon before, and the Cut and Restored Rope, which I learned from Charlie Miller. And they were the only three stand-up tricks that I knew. So I just...
20 minutes right there?
That was it. And that was my core act. It took me about 15 to 18. And I still do those same three tricks now, after 42 years.
Are you finding some lines that you've added over the years?
Oh, what I'm doing now is completely different than what I was doing then.
Of course.
You know, they morph into something over the years.
But I know things get tighter and tighter, but then also that you might hear something. Well, I'm going to throw this in. See this? And you know, I think of like Bob Reed, for an example. You know, he can do a half hour and then finally produce a bottle.
Yeah,
know?
Of course. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I have one particular routine, the Chase the Ace, you know, these days it has about a 6-minute introduction before I actually get to doing the trick. And that, I didn't intend to happen, it just, a line came in, a bit came in, and slowly it came in, yeah.
So it's important to listen to your audience, obviously.
Oh, I used to tape record every show.
Did you?
Yeah, I had a little tape recorder. And I know quite a few people will do this. They'll tape their shows and listen to what they're doing. But I never used to listen to what I was saying. I would listen to the audience. And if there was 2 or 3 minutes of dead silence, I would go, okay, I need to change that.
There's, sure.
I need to put something or take something out to... So I would listen, and especially when I started working the comedy club circuit, which is a horrible circuit to work, but that was what I did.
Were you counting your laughs per minute?
Counting laughs per minute, yeah. And if I didn't get 4 laughs a minute, then I had to rewrite to get it in.
Yeah, you have to have at least 4, I would think, yeah.
But my my favorite line about laughs per minute was Lou Derman and Senator Crandall. Crandall was the funniest man alive.
Never met him.
Oh, he was a brilliant guy. Lou Derman was the writer, chief writer for Mr. Ed. So he was a great comedy writer.
You can put words in the horse's mouth.
Really? He worked every Friday night at the Magic Cast. They called him Friday Night Lou because he would work the close-up room every Friday night. And he was one of the last of the deadpan comics. You know, never cracked a smile, never moved his face at all as he delivered his material. But there's a rivalry between them. One day, Crandall meets Lou at the bar after Lou had just come out. Crandall said, I just did my show downstairs, Lou. I counted. I got 112 laughs. And Lou thought for a second, he said, I only got 1. It started when I walked out, and it finished when I walked off.
That's good. Yeah, only 1. In developing the cardiographic, how did that... Did it start off as a close-up trick, you know, or was it always envisioned as a larger trick?
No, I actually had... There was a book, I think it was by Sid Lorraine, I think, maybe not. But it was called Thinking with a Pencil, and it was a book on creativity and using pencil and paper to sketch your ideas out. And so I just read the book and I thought, okay, I'm going to put, now this is going to go into practice. So I get my sketch pad and I get a paper and I start sketching ideas for tricks. And I thought, let's see what I can do with the rising card. So I started sketching different ideas with rising cards. And then I flipped the page and I drew a goblet with a deck of cards in it. And I thought, I wonder if I could just have it rise right here on this sketch. And that was...
That's how it developed.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to ask you about creativity. I mean, how these things come to you. Do you find it's best when you just kind of have a free form of thought and you just start jotting things down on your paper, or you wake up in the middle of the night and jot things down, or you're inspired by music or something you see or someone else's effect? Or
I never know where it's going to come from.
So you don't like set aside a time a day and say, okay, I'm going to be creative right now.
No, I think about it all the time.
Okay.
You know, I wrote a column in Magic Magazine for a while, and now I'm writing in Genie. Genie, I'm only doing every other month, which gives me 2 months to write up it. But I have one due at the end of this month, and I have no idea what it's going to be yet.
You are not scared of the blank page, are you? I mean, like, you don't have writer's block? I mean, you...
No. Oh, yeah, I have writer's block. I have no idea what it's going to be if I if I knew it. So I just carry on looking at things and watching things. And here at the convention, I'll see something that will... I'll go, oh, you know, that, and then I'll take something from prior knowledge. And creativity can be learned. It can, just like you can learn to play the piano.
I agree. It's a muscle that can be exercised.
Yeah. And one way of thinking about things, Billy McComb told me, we have a tendency to place one thought on top of another.
Okay.
So if you imagine the thought as being a brick, and you lay that brick in front of you, then that brings another thought. So you take that second brick and put it on top of the first one. And then those two create another thought. So you put another... After a while, you've built a wall of thought in front of you, and you can't see beyond it. However, if instead of putting one brick on the other, you lay it behind the first brick, and then the next one you lay behind, so you can stand back and you can survey all of these bricks all laid out in a big row, then... You can take one from the top left corner and one from the bottom right corner, and you can see them both together and put them together. And sometimes putting two ideas together is where you get a new idea from.
Just like the idea we were talking about with Matt King with the Cloak of Invisibility, had those two different things from parts of his life, and they just happened to come together.
Yeah, they just gel together,
But you have to actually lay them out like that, as opposed... I love that visual of creating a wall that you can't see beyond, and then you're stuck. It's like, this is the only way that it can be.
Yeah. The trick in the current magazine, the colossal floating card, years ago I read a trick in a little booklet where you make a coin float in the air in front of you, and the method was you had a hat pin with some wax on the end and a potato stuck in the front of your pants.
Okay.
And you stick the coin on the wax, and then you stick the needle into the hat pin into the potato, and you can move your hands away,
right,
and the coin seems to float as long as you've got the right angles.
Angle, right.
And I thought, well, that's a clever idea, but I'm never going to be sticking a hat pin in my stomach,
potato
in your
pants,
not. Yeah. Is that a potato in your pants?
Yeah.
Or yeah? And later on, so I said, okay, I'm going to revisit that idea from this next column. But I'm going to float a card. But I'm going to make it a big card, and I need a card trick to go with it. So I thought, well, if I use a double-faced card, I can do that old two-card Monty thing. So I combined the two-card Monty with this idea. When that first came out, they didn't have the technology that we have today. So now, using a powerful magnet and some steel strip, I can make a card float, and it looks amazing.
Yeah, thinking about that, I thought that Mike Caveney had something that was like a piece of tin or something that would be like in your belt buckle or something whenever he was doing a linking coat hanger.
Coat hangers, yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
And then someone also had a floating dove, something that would swing out from your belt, I believe.
Yeah.
And you could put a dove, you know, to sleep and it looked like it'd float right in front of you.
Yes, I'm now another senior moment, but yes, I just saw that. It's very clever as well.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, this idea of having something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So the nice thing about mine is all the gimmicks are built into the card. So you can pick it up and you can do it and put it away and it's and that's it.
Right. Right.
And even with I came up with a method where you can do it in t-shirt and shorts on the beach if you want.
Wow.
So this one's very practical.
What is one of your favorite impromptu types of tricks? I mean, if someone says, you know, he's a magician, particularly when you're on a cruise ship, you get that all the time. You know, so you're at the table with the guests or whatever and say, yeah, you know, that they expect you to do something. What would be something that you like?
It depends on
situation.
On the situation.
Yeah. Whether you have a deck of cards. Typically, I don't use cards. I try to do something organic with a paper napkin or whatever.
Yeah. Years ago, when people smoked, I used to like to do the assembly of you tear a cigarette into four pieces and put the four pieces in a corner and do a matrix with two napkins and then end up with the cigarette restoring.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that. That was my go-to trick.
Okay.
In the bar, if I can find a swizzle stick that has a pattern on one side so I can do a paddle routine. I forget, and I'm embarrassed to say I don't recall whose idea this is, but it's a very clever idea. I'll say, I want you to imagine there's three coins in a row on the table. There's a quarter, there's a penny, there's a dime.
Okay.
Now I want you to pick up one of the coins, but before that, I'm going to make a prediction, I'll place something on the table and put my hand over it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I say, okay, now you've chosen the dime. I want you to flip it and tell me, is it heads or tails? And they say heads. And I go, the funny thing is you could have chosen any coin, you could have landed heads or tails, but look, when you lift up your hand, there's a dime with the heads face up.
Yeah.
It's very clever, and whoever thought of that was a bona fide genius. Because you get all the effects with only just one coin.
Right.
And it doesn't matter, penny, quarter, whatever you've got in your pocket.
Sure.
So that was my go-to. It still is. So I do that quite a lot.
Well, that's a good impromptu kind of a thing then as well. Well, listen, I've taken a lot of your time. Thank you so very much. It's good to get to know you a little bit better as well, Martin. And the name of my podcast, as you know, is called The Magic Word. And so my question, as I always close out, is to ask my guests, what is your magic word? And I don't mean like abracadabra or whatever. What is your philosophy of life? It could be a phrase, a sentence. What do you live by? What's important to you?
Keep it simple.
Ooh, that's good. I like that.
Well, you know, KISS, right?
Yeah, of course, yes.
But yeah, for magic, simplicity is the hardest thing to do.
Isn't that what Vernon always was saying? Is kind of make it to the point. Keep it simple. You know.
And Don Allen was the master of getting to the point.
Mm-hmm.
I see people do these horrendously long, complicated chop cup routines. Don said, the trick is producing a big ball under that cup.
That's what they remember.
Get there as fast as you can.
Yeah.
So keep it simple, yeah.
That's excellent. Good advice. Thank you very much. So for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Martin Lewis, and this is Scotty Out. Wow, that was a lot of fun, and entertaining and educational as well. I had again expected just to have a brief conversation with Martin. As it turned out, as you heard, it got to be a little bit longer because he just had a lot of really interesting things to talk about, and I think I could have gone on a little bit longer, but he was having to go someplace, and so did I. That was a very busy convention and a lot of fun here in Louisville. So I want to thank Martin for being my guest this week, and I hope that you guys had some fun and you learned some things then as well. He's, again, very creative guy, and maybe if you can take some of his ideas and apply that to your own performances, I think we'll all be a little bit better off. So now it's time for some product reviews from Murphy's Magic Supplies and available from your favorite magic dealer, like themagicwordpodcast.com. Just go over to our magic store and you can purchase these items directly there on the website.
This week we're going to cover three different items, and two of which are card effects, and the other one is a non-card effect. All of which, however, are close-up things that I would say are ideal for strolling if you're going to be doing something for a restaurant or a cocktail party or whatever. The first of the tricks I'm really excited about, and you probably would be too, just by the names of the people who are involved with this, who present this. This is by Paul Harris and Bro Gilbert, both very creative guys, and never release anything except that which is top-notch, and this is no exception. It's called Quantum Angel, and this is actually a kind of a continuation of the Cardian Angel, yeah, by Paul Harris and Mike Maxwell from a while back. And Quantum Angel is, you might be familiar with Dan Harlan's cartoon deck in which you kind of flip through there and a little stick figure takes off his top hat, pulls out the card of whatever. So this is similar in a way, except you have a much smaller packet of cards, and essentially that one of the angels on the back of a bicycle card will disappear, fly away, go back, and then pull out this little envelope. When I say little envelope, it's a little white envelope that is about the size of a nickel, roughly, smaller than a quarter or something around that size. And then they can open up the envelope. You can actually take the envelope physically off of the card, or another variation, there's the card stays on there. You just open the seal to the envelope. You reach inside, or they reach inside and kind of slide out to this little prediction, and it can be just a little piece of paper, or they can unfold it and be about a 2-inch by 2-inch prediction, and inside there would be written whatever kind of a prediction that you want to place in there, whether it's going to be the name of the card that they had freely selected or not. So this is just a very clever idea, and there are different variations of this particular trick, and you get a lot of really cool stuff that comes with it. I mean, not just the little packet of cards, but also there are some variations that have to do with the name of a person. For an example, that if you would say, I want you to think of the name of someone who is near to you, and they say, let's say, Kathy. So they would, you say, and also they select a playing card. And then you take out a Sharpie, and then you're writing a prediction before they take the card, and then they hold on to your prediction, which is on the back of your business card or something. You then recap the pen, and then whenever that you go through the deck of cards, so you kind of flip through it, and they select a playing card, and then later, whenever they turn that your prediction over, of course, that matches with your card, then you go through and do the quantum angel idea, in which that as you're flipping through that, then it shows their this little envelope that appears. They reach inside, and inside would be this little piece of paper. They open it and says, Kathy. So it could be something kind of like that, or they have a lot of different ideas and suggestions, even like for birthday parties. So this way that the prediction inside could be that if the child should then go to ask the parent, where the or go look in the closet, there you'll find your birthday gift, or go look behind the tree or whatever, or outside or something. So you have a little prediction of something's going to be happening that way. There are a lot of other ideas in which you can do this, let's say in a corporate environment, in which that you would have the name of your clients, or their phone number, your phone number, whatever's going to be inside. A lot of different ideas, whatever that you want to use, let your imagination go for that. Now, one of the things also that they have surrounding the card is kind of like the idea of the out to lunch principle, basically. But this is another, well, let me just say, there's another idea that they do that does not require that out-to-lunch principle. And I say principle in that there's a half card with this elastic that's around it. You don't have to use that in order to force a card. You can take that off, and they give you an idea for using making a Svengali deck of your own and then incorporating these quantum angels. Anyhow, very, very clever trick, very good idea, something I would recommend. Again, this is called Quantum Angel by Paul Harris and Bro Gilbert. Next up is a DVD and a gimmick that's included with the DVD called Trojan Horse by Stephen Himmel. And this is, again, another clever card trick using a gimmick. And he tells you in the very beginning of this DVD how to make the gimmick if you want to use it with different types of cards, different back cards. If you have something, let's say, that you're going to be doing it in a trade show where that a company has their logoed cards, you can use it in that fashion. It tells you how to make this little gimmick. But essentially, the effect of this is that it's a sandwich card effect. Let's say you have two jokers, and you would place a card between the two jokers. They immediately disappear, and then it ends up back inside the deck upside down. That would be their card. Or that it could be that there's going to be a card, then once you take that card out, put it back between the two cards, and now it changes colors. And it could be, and you're showing both of the jokers, let's say, completely free and clean. There are four different effects that are taught on this DVD, and one of them also has to do with coins. So this way that you can have them, let's say, draw a dollar bill sign on a blank card. And whenever that you put that between the two cards, that as you slowly put the card between the two and you tilt the cards forward, a dollar coin, let's say, will fall out into their hands. So it's something that could be a combination of cards and coins, and then you can go into a coin routine with that and have a couple of the coins or whatever to go with it. Again, there are another thing was a thought of card sandwich. It's called a horse whisperer. That's fairly clever. Anyhow, this is a nice little gimmick, easy to use. This is beginner level and not too difficult really at all. His explanations are quite thorough and clean and understandable. So this is, again, one of those little things that's clever and I would recommend. It's called Trojan Horse by Stephen Himmel. We're going to round out our threesome here for this week's product reviews with Screen Test, the Pocket Edition from Alakazam Magic in the UK. This is a smaller version of the larger one. The larger one is about postcard size. This is really kind of, baseball card size, kind of playing card size, but they look like baseball cards, you know, basically. The effect is exactly the same, in which that you have a series of cards, let's say 12 or 15 reproductions of movie posters. And written on the back of the movie posters is a list of all of those that are in this particular collection. And with that, you would then get a you have the volunteer to take a look at the movies and their variety of movies. There could be animated, action, old movies, new movies, comedies, drama, rom-coms, whatever. So they will select a movie and then hand the rest of them back to you, or they can just hang on to that one, take one out, and all they have to do is then read the back of the card in any order that they wish, so that way it's randomized, and then you tell them what movie it is that they're holding. It's a very clever idea, and in fact, the idea itself, I think, is beautiful. I took this idea and actually used it at the Magic Castle when I was performing earlier this year, and developed my own effect, same effect, but my own trick using different cards. Let me just say that with this, that one of the movies that is not as well known, or I should say a series of movies, which is not as well known in the United States, is called Carry On. Apparently that it is a series of movies, Carry On, different things. I'm, again, not sure what it is. I guess it is a comedy, but they're not as well known in the U.S. as they are in the U.K. However, that James Bond is well known throughout the world. So without going into any detail, I would just say that I made this my own by changing the Carry On movies to the James Bond movies. So if this is something that you're thinking of purchasing, you might be interested in maybe revising this and making it your own by doing what I had done. But it will require a lot of work if you want to make this uniquely your own. But this is ready to go right out of the pack. It's a very good trick. I like the jumbo version. That's why that I'm glad that they have this smaller pocket size version that you can carry around and do with you in a strolling environment. but I recommend it. It's called Screen Test Pocket Edition by Steve Dimmer. Well, I hope this helps you with your product decision-making, because there are a lot of Magic products that are coming out all the time, seems like every day, certainly every week, and there are a lot of different ways that you can go about finding and purchasing these things. You can find product demonstrations easily online just about any place, but when it comes down to trying to buy a product, you really don't know if it's really that good or not, or something that might work for you. That's why I go into a lot of detail in trying to explain these things to you, and I hope that my product reviews will help you. They're honest reviews. There are things that I believe that will work or won't work, or if there are some problems with it, I try to identify those as well so that you can make a more informed decision when it comes to buying products. Murphy's Magic Supplies has thousands of different items that are available. And again, these are things you can purchase directly from your favorite magic dealer, which again, I hope would be me. That is the Magic Word Podcast. Just go to themagicwordpodcast.com and there you'll see the magic store. Click on that and you can buy these items directly from our store, and they'll be shipped to you very quickly. So thank you again for your patronage, and that's another way that you can help support this podcast. Well, I think that's a wrap for another week. And again, I want to thank my guest, Martin Lewis, who seems to be kind of the modern-day Ali Bongo. He's one of these very creative guys. And if you ever get an opportunity to hear his lecture, whether it's going to be at a magic convention or if he goes out on tour or any place at all, I would suggest that you go and see and hear him. He's got a lot of really good ideas, completely different and original. And for my money, they're the kind of things that I would incorporate and put into my routine. In fact, I have done several of the things or put some things in, and he's got, again, a lot of great ideas, and so I want to thank Martin for sharing those ideas with the Magic Fraternity and also for sharing his words with us here this week. And so, until next week, stay well, get booked, and keep it simple. This is Scotty out.